Now we're holding on page Zion in Sota Osiyot Zion. We learned yesterday a drasha from Rav Chanina bar Papa. For the first version of it was Hashem doesn't punish a nation outside of the Jewish people until it's time for them to be gone completely, and then Hashem gives them one zetz and that's it, they're gone. And then we said that doesn't seem to work because we see that Mitzrayim went through many different disasters in its a couple of disasters in its history. So then the Gemara had changed it and said that Rav Chanina bar Papa is saying that it's as far as a king. That Hashem doesn't punish a goyish king until it's time for him to be gone. And then we had another version that the Gemara said, that the Gemara had said, Rav Chanina bar Papa had said, that Hashem never used the same punishment twice on the same nation. Every time Hashem gives a different punishment, as we learned yesterday, as Maharsha says this way, they don't think that Hashem has power only in one particular element. So now, having brought that, so the Gemara brings another drasha from the same Rav Chanina bar Papa, as it often does. So drasha Rav Chanina or Rav Chananya bar Papa, my dichtiv, and what does it mean? The pasuk says, "Ranenu tzadikim b'Hashem," sing and then sing and shout out and enjoy tzadikim in Hashem. La'isharim for the righteous, nova sehila. Praise is appropriate. So the simple meaning of nova sehila means exactly that. It's appropriate for the tzadikim to praise Hashem. But Maharsha says the Gemara is bothered by why ranenu tzadikim b'Hashem. You would expect it to say la Hashem. Like by the Shira Sayam, for example, or Shira La Hashem, and then many other situations. So what it means is, Nova Sehila, don't read that praise is appropriate, Ela Neve Sehila. Rather read it that Neve, that it's regarding the houses, Nova means a house, that Tehila, they praise Hashem, that the enemies of the Jewish people were never able to get control of the houses for Hashem that were built by certain great tzaddikim. So in other words, therefore, so Bahashem, that they're praising for the fact that Hashem did them this chesed and made sure that what they created, that the houses for Hashem that they created, did not fall into the hands of the enemies. So that means that David or Moshe, so specifically this refers, the tzaddikim over here refers to David and Moshe, their enemies were never able to have any control of the things that they made. We have similarly, by the way, in the Kapitel Hashem Moloch Geus Lovish, we have at the end of the Leveischa Noava Kodesh, Rashi actually explains that they were also the word Noava is from the same word that means a dwelling. Many of the other Mephoshim there it say means that Nava means also appropriate. Anyway, so he was saying the same way, Nova Sehila means that they praise Hashem for their houses that did not fall into the hands of the enemies. What do we mean? David, where's the example? We see that by David. Dichtiv, the pasuk says, "Tovu va'aretz sha'areha." In Eicha, it says, "Her gates sank into the ground." Now, so the previous pasuk says that Hashem decided to destroy the wall of Bas Tzion, and the wall of Yerushalayim. But now we're saying, "Tovu va'aretz sha'areha," its gates sank into the ground. So Rashi explains what it means is like this: We're not talking about the Beis Hamikdash. Because David himself didn't build the Beis HaMikdash. We know he wanted to, and he prepared everything for it, but in the end, Shlomo built it. No, what we mean is Yerushalayim. Specifically, Rashi says, we mean the part of Yerushalayim called Mitzudas Tzion, the fortress of Tzion, which afterwards was called Ir David. Nowadays, they use the word Ir David to mean the southern slope below the Har HaBayis, most of which is outside the walls of the old city, and they have a fascinating archaeological digs over there, whether it means only that, or whether Ir David was larger at the beginning, I don't know, but in any case, the point is that the walls of it, the Goyim, when they destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash, they destroyed it, and Hashem planned that should happen. But Tovu Va'aretz Sha'areha, the gates sank into the ground. Meaning, in other words, because otherwise, Maharsha explains that the Goyim would have taken the gates. They were made out of copper or gold or silver. They're precious metals, the Goyim, or at least semi-precious metals. The Goyim would have taken them. On the other hand, they have no reason to take the wood and the stones of Yerushalayim, so those were just left in place. So it comes out, basically, that the Goyim didn't end up taking anything of what David had built, of this Mitzudas Tzion, David, which David rebuilt after he conquered Yerushalayim. None of that fell into the hands of the enemies, in the sense, the one thing they would have taken, the gates sank into the ground, and everything else they didn't bother with. That's the point of Rashi. Maharsha brings that actually this is where that's not referring to the city of Yerushalayim, it is referring to the Beis HaMikdash. And Tovu Va'aretz Sha'areha in particular refers to the gates of the Beis HaMikdash. So, and he brings And he brings from a medrash that the reason is because the gates of the Beis Mikdash showed covered to the Oren. We say in Tilim that when they're bringing the Oren into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, Su Sharim Rasheichem, V'yinosu Pischeilam, Unusu Pischeilam, Mizem Malach HaKavod, Hashem Tzvokas, Malach HaKavod Sela, and the gates open in honor of the Oren, and therefore in the schus of that, they were not captured and taken by the enemies. So therefore, so it would have to refer, says Marsha, it would refer to the gate to the Beis Mikdash. Now, Maharsha says, in that case, then the fact is, Shlomo built the Beis Mikdash, but David prepared everything for it, and he bought the site of the Beis Mikdash, and even as far as the gates only opened up, besides that they opened in honor of the Shekhinah, they still didn't open up until Shlomo davened that Hashem should answer in the schus of David, so therefore the gates can be credited to David, and we're saying those gates sank into the ground. Even Yaakov makes another point as well. He says, the fact is, we could very well say that David actually, along with preparing everything that he could for the Beis Mikdash, he may well have made the actual gates. They're not ready to be installed yet, because the Beis Mikdash, the structure of the Beis Mikdash has to be built first, but it's very possible, says Even Yaakov, that David actually crafted the gates, and therefore they can be credited to him. Anyway, the point is, so we see that David's handiwork did not fall into the hands of the enemies. Famously it says, when Mashiach comes, then those gates will emerge from underground and will be installed in the third Beis HaMikdash. So that's as far as David. Moshe, where do we see that Moshe's handiwork didn't fall into the hands of the enemies? We learn in a Braisa, Mishan Nivnam Niknas Rishon, when the first Beis HaMikdash was built and they no longer needed the Mishkan, Nignas Oyel Moed, at that point they put the Oyel Moed into storage, into Gniza, in the tunnels underneath the Beis HaMikdash, and not just the Oyel Moed in general, but all the individual parts, cross of the hooks, crush of the beams, brich of the crossbars, va'amuda of the pillars of the chotzer, va'adonav and the sockets that held everything up. So all of those were hidden away under the Beis Mikdash, and they're still there adayim azeh. So therefore they never fell into the hands of the enemies. Why we mention these particular five things, then Yehoyada gives a long explanation that it has to do with the five letters of Shem Elikim, and he goes into a long explanation about the significance of these particular names. But anyway, the point is, so that's the Gemara says, Heicha, where were they buried? Amar Rav Chisda, Amar Rav Emi, Tachas Mechilas Shel Heichel, in the underground tunnels underneath the Beis Mikdash, and that's where the Oren is, according to many opinions as well. So therefore, so those never fell into the hands of the enemies, and therefore we're saying that David also, that both David and Moshe, the enemies never gained control of the things that they made. There's other areas in which we also have. We have, for example, by David, we have David Melech Yisrael Chai B'Kayam. By Moshe, it says later on in the Perek that Moshe lay mess, Moshe never passed away. So they have a nitzchius in their own lives as well. There's the idea, for example, that what they accomplished for the Jewish people in general has a permanence. Moshe took us out of Mitzrayim, and ever since then, a Yid can never be a slave, can never truly be enslaved to another nation. David created the Jewish kingship, and that lasts for Hashem. David was the first king of the Jewish people. It started with him, and it continues on forever, and it'll be reinstated with Mashiach. There's a why particularly them. One point is it talks about Chassidus, because they showed ultimate Chassidus Nefesh for Hashem. And as far as Moshe in particular, it's brought there's a famous thing that Moshe, when Moshe wants to go into Eretz Yisrael, Hashem tells him one reason you can't is because if you take them into Eretz Yisrael, they'll never be able to go into Golos. And then what is Hashem going to do when it comes time when the Jewish people have to be punished? He won't be able to do Golos, and instead there'll have to be something worse, Chassidus Shalom, and therefore it has to be that Moshe can't be the one to bring him in. In a similar vein, it says about David that he also, when he wants to build the Beis Mikdash, Hashem tells him, one reason you can't, same thing, it'll never be destroyed, and then there's no, that Hashem will not be able to take out his anger on the Jewish people, on the wood and stones of the Beis Mikdash, and therefore it had to be built by Shlomo. So again, Nova Sehila, they can both praise Hashem, Ran Tzadik and Bashem, that Hashem arranged things that it shouldn't fall into the hands of the Goyim. Okay. Continues the Gemara. Getting back to the Sota, Tananabanan, Sota Nosna Ener B'misha Enish Shalah Uroi La. The Sota is Mizana with somebody who's not her husband. So she's looking, she's putting her eyes on somebody who is not hers, or somebody who's not Roy for her, because she's married and she has no business being with this other guy. The result is Masha Dikshala Nitnla. What she wants is not given to her, first of all because she dies as a Sota, but more to the point, also, even if she survives the thing, Somehow or other, Rashi points out that she's still also to the boil later on. In the Masechta, it talks about the din, kashem shasur labal, kachasur laboil, so she's also forever to this guy that she was mizana with, or we have reason to suspect that she was mizana with him. So what she wanted is not given to her. Or mashi v'yada, nafla mimena, and what she already had, she also loses. So again, if she drinks the mei soita and is guilty, she dies. And if she admits, then she's also to her husband and forfeits her ksuba. So we see, in other words, sometimes a person wants more than what they deserve, and they end up even losing what they already had. Here the Gemara is going to bring a bunch of examples further down. An example is Bilam. The Gemara in Sanhedrin has an expression about that. It says that the camel wanted himself horns, so he goes to a place where he thinks they'll put horns on him, and in the end, not only he doesn't get horns, he loses his ears. So the same way Bilam, as we'll learn soon, thought he's going to get a reward for causing many thousands of Jews to be killed in a plague because of his advice, and he wound up losing his life. He ended up getting killed together with the kings and the people of Midian. Anyway, so the Braisa continues. That's a general rule. Anybody who does that, anybody who puts their eyes and their attention on something that doesn't that's not appropriate for them, what he wants, he's not going to get, like the sota, or what he already has, he's going to lose as well. Beni Hoyada points out a cute word in that, and we learned it before, about midah k'neged midah. Like this, he puts his ayin yud nun, on something that doesn't belong, and instead he becomes oni, ayin nun yud, and loses what he has already. We find an example of that with the Nochash HaKadmoni in Gan Eden. He wanted Chava. He intended that Adam should die from eating from the Eitz Hadas, and then he'd be able to marry Chava. Rashi refers to in other places where it says, the Medrash brings, when Chava says, when Hashem confronts Chava and says, how could you eat from the Eitz Hadas? And she says, Hanochash Shi'ani Va'Oichel, which literally means the Nochash convinced me, and so I ate from the Eitz Hadas, but we also dash in Shi'ani, as if it was with a sin, Meloshin Nisuin. Like, to a certain extent, they were married, not literally that they had relations. It talks about in Sifrei Kabbalah, but it means, in other words, as the Gemara says in some places, that the Nochash put a zuama, put a ruchni, a stick of filth into Chava and into her descendants, which by the Jewish people persisted until Matan Torah, and by the Goyim still remains to this very day. So he intended to get rid of Adam and marry Chava. So therefore, he was putting his eyes and planning to have Chava, who's not appropriate for him because she's married to Adam. So the same thing. What he wanted wasn't given to him. He didn't end up with Chava. What he already had, the milus that he had before, he lost. Specifically, Rashi says, the fact that the snake used to stand upright. Namely, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, Ani amarti yehi melech al kol behem v'chaya. I had planned that the Nochash would be the king of all the domestic and wild animals. That's why when the pasuk says Anochash Haya Orum, that the Nochash was particularly clever among all the animals, that was why Hashem made him that he should be the melech over all of them. He would be to the animals. He would be like the Adam among the animals, so to speak. He'd be like the analog of Adam among the animals. Achshav, now that he misused his craftiness and his shrewdness, and instead Oru Yir Atam Mikol Behema or Mikol Chayas Asada. Now Hashem says, instead, you're going to be cursed more than all the domestic and the wild animals. One meaning of that curse is, the Gemara tells us in Bechoras, that a snake's pregnancy is longer than that of any other creature. Other creatures, the maximum is 1 year pregnancy, approximately, and a snake, 7 years. The Gemara there actually learns it from the Psukim. Another example, on Yamarki Yelech Bekoimus Skufa, I figured that, I planned, says Hashem, that these Nochas should walk upright, and as the Gemara mentions elsewhere, it would have been a very useful servant for a person. Achshav, Agachona Yelech, now instead he loses that, and he gets his feet chopped off, and he has to slither around on his belly. I planned that the Nochas should be eating the same kind of refined food that people eat. Achshav, instead, Ba'ofer Yoichal, now instead he eats dust. Which the Gemara elsewhere mentions two possibilities. Either it means that a Nochash is never satisfied until he eats dust, or that everything tastes to him like dust. Whatever, that's also, he lost something that he would have had if he lost a Maila that he would have had. The Nochash had thought to himself, Erig Odom, the SS Chava, I'm going to cause Odom to be killed And then I'll marry Chava, like we said, Lofichach or Achshav. Now instead, as Hashem says, Ve'eva Oshis, Ben Chol Ve'ne Isha, O Ven Zara, Chol Ven Zara, now there's going to be an eternal hatred between you and the woman, and between your descendants, snakes in the future, and the descendants of Chava, all of humanity. Everybody hates and fears and is repulsed by snakes. So we see that the Nachash was trying to get something he didn't deserve, and he winds up losing so much. Now, the big question is, that a number of the Mephoshim deal with, how exactly was the Nachash planning this? What do you mean he's going to cause Adam to die and marry Chava? The fact is, he got Chava to eat from the Eitz Hadas as well. Well, then she's going to die also, so where is he going to be able to accomplish this plot of his? So Marsha says, listen, like this. We know that Hashem commanded Adam not to eat from the Eitz Hadas, but that was before Chava was even cut out from Adam and separated from him, as we see in the Psukim. Hashem tells Adam in Perek Bein, in Bereshis, in Perek Beis, Pasuk Tes Zayin, not to eat from Pasuk Tes Zayin Yud Zayin, not to eat from the Eitz Hadas. Later on in Pasuk Chafala Chaf Beis, and Hashem puts him to sleep and cuts Chava out of him. So therefore, but Chava had but we see that Chava obviously was commanded not to eat from it. And the reason is because when Hashem commanded Adam, then it also included Chava, who at the time was part of him. Now, the Marsha brings from a Medrash that there was a Goy who actually argued that maybe not. Maybe Chava wasn't commanded, and why should she be punished? And Rav Abba explains to her that no, she actually was commanded because Adam was commanded, and she was part of him at that time. So now, as far as Adam and Chava are concerned, as far as they know, she's included in it as well. But the Nachash tries to convince her. We know that Adam went and gave an extra siyog on it. He told her not only don't eat it, but don't touch it either. And he didn't make it clear that not touching it is not from Hashem, which is how the Nachash had his opening, as Rashi mentions on the Pasuk. He pushed her against the tree and she didn't die. And he says, see, you didn't die from touching it. You won't die from eating it either. So now, what the Nachash figures, therefore, is what is he going to do? He's going to mislead. So now that he's misled Chava, so now what will happen is, she'll think now if she eats it, she won't die. On the other hand, Adam will die, because after all, he was directly commanded by Hashem, and Chava not so directly as that Goy thinks in the Medrash. So therefore, so the Nachash thinks that there might be some way that he'd actually be able to end up marrying Chava. Again, that Adam will end up dying because of that, but Chava will be able to survive it. Then there's several other explanations. Ion Yaakov says a variation of that. Adam heard it personally from Hashem, as opposed to Chava did not hear it directly from Hashem, only from Adam. So therefore, maybe the Nachash figures she won't necessarily be deserving of death for it, and therefore will have an opportunity to marry her. And then there are various other explanations and various other ideas how exactly he could do that. So one point is, Ben Yehoyada makes another point as well. First, he mentions that point, that again, Adam heard directly from Hashem and Chava didn't. But another point is, he thinks, listen, after all, there has to be a humanity in the world. So Adam, but all you need in order to conceive children, Adam has to have relations with Chava. Then at that point, he can die. He's not needed for them, he's not needed for children anymore. So on the other hand, Chava is at least going to have to live through the pregnancy and the nursing of the children. So therefore, he figures there's a couple of years over there that he has his opportunity with Chava. The Braisa continues, V'chein Matsinu, we have many, many other examples of that in Jewish history, of people who wanted something that they didn't have, that they didn't deserve, and they ended up losing something that they even already had. But Kayin, we find it with Kayin. Rashi explains that we know that together with Kayin there was born a twin sister, and together with Hevel there were born two twins. So Hevel was part of a triplet. So now part of the argument between Kayin and Hevel, which eventually Kayin killed Hevel, was he wanted that extra girl. The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that Rashi brings it in Chumash in Parshas for Achrei Mos that Kayin and Hevel married their sisters because Olam Chasid Yibana, but Kayin was arguing that he should be entitled to that extra one because he's the Bechor and he gets a double portion. Meanwhile, Hevel is arguing that she's his because she was born together with him. Anyway, so Kayin wants that, and he ends up losing even what he had because he ends up getting sent into Golos and eventually getting killed and so forth. Marsha has a different explanation. First of all, he says that no, based on the Gemara, it may be that actually the Gemara in Yevamos may disagree with that Medrash and say that only one girl was born together with Hevel. No, what it is Maharal Shah says that the Medrash also mentions that Cain and Hevel were arguing what's going to be with the world. Cain took the land, Hevel took the metaltlin, and then they get into an argument about it. So Cain wants what's not Roy to him. Here they've split it up. It was agreed that Hevel will have the metaltlin, but now Cain is getting jealous and trying to take the metaltlin as well and kill Hevel and take that. And the result is he lost even the land that was supposed to be his because, as Hashem tells him, that you're cursed through the land, namely that you're not going to be able to cultivate the land and nova nub tiabarex and all of that. Ian Yaakov says a variation on that with Cain wanted the whole world for himself. He figures he kills Hevel, then he's the sole heir. What happens in the end? Shace is born. Shace's descendants are the ones who inherit the world. Cain and his and all of his progeny were destroyed in the marble. So either way, we have in all these various ways, we see that Cain lost even what he had before. The Korach, the next example is Korach, who wanted the Kohen Gadol and the leadership of the Jewish people, and he wound up losing everything and getting swallowed up into the ground. Or Bilam, we find the same thing with Bilam, like we just said before. He wanted to be paid by Balak for the fact that his advice had caused 24,000 Jews to be killed in the plague after the whole story of Baal Peor in Shittim. And the result was that he ended up losing his life. He was there in Midian when the Jewish people fought against it, and he got killed over there. The Doeg, the next example we have is Doeg. He was the apostle calls him Abir Haroyim, the mighty one among the shepherds of Shaul, which means that he was the great Talmud Chacham of that time. The Medrash even says he was the Av Beis Din of that time. Rashi just says over here, Gadol Shel Tamidim, he was the greatest of the Talmud Chachamim. Anyway, he was jealous of David, that he was jealous of David's prowess in Torah. So therefore, so he wanted what was not his. He wanted to get David out of the way, and now he'll be the unquestioned greatest Talmud Chacham. And in the end, he lost what he even had because he died young. And the Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin that before he died, he lost his knowledge of Torah. Achitophel, we have the same thing with Achitophel, where he wanted the kingship for himself. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that he had a vision that he interpreted to mean that he's going to become the king, and that is in fact why he supported Avshalom's revolt and wanted David to be killed, and so on and so forth. In the end, what happened was that he himself, once he saw that the revolt is not going to go anywhere, Avshalom's revolt, which we'll talk about in the next couple of Daphim, and then he ended up strangling himself, and he lost even what he had. He even lost his chelik in the mabah. So he lost even what he had. The Gehazi, the next example is Gehazi, the Talmud of Elisha. He wanted Naaman's money, which Elisha had refused after curing Naaman, in Naftorah, of Parshas Tazria, this week's Parshas. And he lost. He ended up getting Saras, and he lost even what he had. The Avshalom, the next example is Avshalom, wanted the kingship, and he wound up getting himself killed, as we're going to talk about soon. Ben Yehoyada points out that Adoniah, who lived before Adoniah, and the next example is Adoniah, another son of David, who also, first of all, he also tried to make himself king and failed. David got wind of it and appointed and had Shlomo crowned as king instead. It's not Torah of Chayasara, but in addition, after that, the pasuk goes on to tell us how Adoniah wanted to marry Avishag Ashunamis, the beautiful girl that David had as his bed warmer, like it talks about at the beginning of Malachim, and in the end, for that, he lost his life because Shlomo realized that he's going to use that as a stepping stone to try and mount a revolt and try to take the kingship for himself. And so Shlomo had him executed as a murder by Malchus. So he wanted what's not deserving of him because Abishag had served a king. She's off limits for a commoner like Adoniyahu, and therefore, for that, he lost his life. Then Yehoyada points out that Gehazi lived after Avshalom and Adoniyahu. Why is he listed earlier than them? And he says, because since Bilam and Doeg and Achitophel and Gehazi are four people who are all mentioned in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, that they all lost the Chelek and Mabah, so therefore it mentions over here Gehazi also together with the other three, and then it continues with the chronological order. The next one is Uziyahu, the king of Yehuda, Uziyahu. He wanted to offer Ketores to Hashem in the Beis Hamikdash, and in the end, he got Saras, and he wound up losing the ability to serve as king as well. For the rest of his life, he had to live, as the pasuk says, Beis HaChofshes, in a place in the Beis HaKvaris, separated from everybody else, and his son Yosam had to run the kingship in his absence. So he wanted what's not fitting for him, because he's from Malchus Beis David. He's not supposed to be bringing Ketores, and he lost that. And the last example, Haman, where he wanted to destroy the Jewish people, and he wound up losing his life and his property and everything for that. So all of them, Shenosner and Ne'er. In fact, the Medrash, by the way, makes an explicit comparison. We have at the beginning of this list is the Nachash HaKadmoni. The end one is Haman, and the Medrash actually makes a comparison between them. By both of them, you have the word Ach. The Nachash begins his speech to Chava. He says Ach ki Omar Elokim. Haman says Ach lo hevia Esther Amalka, and the result was they were both destroyed by the Eibishter's Ach. By the Eibishter's anger. Anyway, so all of them, Shenosner and Ne'er, B'masha Enish Lahem, or Roy Lahem, all of them were casting their eyes and wanting something that's not suitable for them. And the result is, as we said, Masha Bikshul, and Nitin Lahem, what they wanted wasn't given to them, or Masha Hoya B'yonim, Nitin Notu Lahem, and what they already had was taken from them. So again, and we see the same thing happens with the Soita. Even Yaakov, by the way, brings up the point. The fact is, the guy she's Mizana with, the boil, is also looking for something that's not his. Why aren't we focusing on him? So he says, listen, I mean, if the guy's unmarried, then there's nothing to take away from him at that point. He's not married yet. And if he is married already, then first of all, he does get that oinish, first of all, because he himself, his wife, may well end up being mizana against him, and therefore he ends up losing his own wife. Besides that, later on in the Masechta, it talks about that the boil gets punished with the exact same thing as the sota. He also, his thigh and his stomach swell up, and he dies the same horrible death. So in that sense, there is also that what he wanted is taken away from what he doesn't get, what he wants. He doesn't get the sota, because she's also to him, and he loses what he already had, his life. The Gemara goes on, Piska, quoting from the Mishnah, Hayerach Hitzchila, because we said that the thigh of the Sota began the Avera first, and after that came the stomach, and therefore, when it comes to the May Sota, then it's listed in that order, first the thigh, then the stomach. So the Gemara asks, Menahani Mili, where do we know that from? Ilema Vashem Dichtiv, the Kohen tells her that Hashem is going to cause your thigh to fall off and your stomach to swell. So we see that the thigh goes first. The problem with that is, but a few psukim later, it says when she drinks the neisoita, and she is in fact guilty, her stomach will swell up, the nafla yerecha, and her thigh will fall off. So we see that it's going to be in that order. So what does the Mishnah mean? That's in the order first thigh, then stomach. Amar Abaya says what it means is like this. Ki liyat, when the Kohen is cursing her, and when he's telling her the curse before he erases the parchment into the water, liyat tchila yerech v'hada beten liyat. Then he does that in that order, first the yerech and then the beten, and that's what the Mishnah means, that the yerech is mentioned first because that was the one, and then Rashi explains, the klala is the beginning of the peronis. The klala is what triggers the peronis to happen as soon as she drinks the mei soita, so therefore when he mentions the yerech first, then it can be said that the klala already begins with the yerech. Umaya kibadki, but when the water actually examines her, when it goes through her body and starts having its effect, Kiyochayu Badki, then it goes in the order in which it goes in the body. The first place it lands in her body is her stomach. Therefore, it starts having an effect there first. And only then, as it goes through her bloodstream, does it then end up in her thigh, and then it starts dealing with that part as well. So you want to ask the Klola Nami Ksiv Latzvis Betin V'lan Po Yarech. Fine, but in the Klola, when the Kohen tells her the whole curse over there, he also says that it's going to be Latzvis Betin, it's going to cause your thigh to swell, V'lan Po Yarech, and it's going to make your thigh fall off. So we see that even in the Klola, the stomach comes first, and yet our Mishnah is saying that the thigh comes first. The answer is, Ahu Demoida La Kohen De Betin Bereish V'Hadu Yarech. That means the Kohen has to inform her that even though earlier I said first Yerech and Betin, but next you should know that when it actually happens, it's going to be Betin first, and then Yerech, Shalei L'Hotzi Laz Amayim Amorim, so that you don't have people talking and saying falsehoods about the Maimorim and saying that it didn't actually work and it's just a coincidence. It would be pretty, you would think it would be, how could anybody think possibly that it could be a coincidence when they see it happen? But people are great at rationalizing, and if people see any tiny detail in which it wasn't the way they expect, then they're going to start claiming that it's all derech hateva and try to make up some rationalistic excuse for it. So in other words, the Kohen starts by saying, Yerech and Betin, for the reason that it said in the Mishnah, because the Yerech was involved in the Aveira first. But then he tells her, the fact is, when you drink it, it's going to have the effect as it goes in the body, Betin first and Yerech. And sure enough, when it actually happens, Betin first and then Yerech. But nevertheless, we can still say that the punishment begins with the Yerech, in the sense that the Kohen mentions it first when he mentions the Klala, and that's what triggers everything to start happening. Maharsha brings, by the way, from Mizrahi on the Pasuk, that actually that the Mizrahi gives a different answer, that when it says, when the Pasuk says, when the Korean says to her, Lasbis Betten, Velan Pil Yarech, that may not be referring to her, that may be referring to the boil, where again, the boil, wherever he is in the world, a Ness is going to happen and he's going to die the same thing. With him, it can be first the Betten and then the Yarech. Maharsha points out there was actually a machloikas on that later in the Masechta. Here we want to say something which is valid, the Chulei Alma, and that would be that when it comes to the woman, it's definitely, it definitely affects Betin first and then Yerach.
Okay.
So the Mishnah starts giving examples of this kind of thing, a Midah Kenegad Midah. We said in the previous Mishnah that the Midah, the way that a person acts, is how Hashem acts with him. So here's some examples from Jewish history. The first example. Shimshon holach achainav. Shimshon followed his eyes, as we'll see, as we'll see in the Gemara. Lefichach nikru plishtim es einav. Therefore, the plishtim put out his eyes. What we mean by so let's recap the story of Shimshon real quick, because the Gemara is going to go into it in some detail. You have the whole story with him before he was born, even. We have that Saftarda of Parshas Nosaya. His parents have been childless for many years. A Malach comes and tells him they're going to have a child, and she has to follow the dinim of a Nazir even before he's born, etc., etc. Then you have Shimshon. Now, Mephoshim explain the difference between Shimshon and all the other Shoftim. Every other Shofet, when it came time to save the Jewish people from the enemies who were harassing them, he would lead the people in battle, and they would defeat the enemy army with Hashem's help, and then they would have peace for many years. However long the Shofet was alive. With Shimshon, they didn't have the schus in that time to do that. Instead, Shimshon had to act alone. And in fact, we have Yaakov's bracha, the Shevet Dan, which that bracha is basically about Shimshon's career. It mentions that he's going to be kinochash al ederach, he's going to be like a snake on the road, attacking very stealthily. Now, Mephoshim explained, the problem is like this. Shimshon knows, if he goes and openly attacks the Plishtim on behalf of the Jewish people, sure, they're not going to be able to touch him because he's powerful because of his Nazirus. But all they'll do is they'll take reprisals against the rest of the Jews and he's not going to be able to defend. He's not going to be available in every place to defend them. What does he have to do? He has to camouflage himself, another meaning of being like a snake. He has to pretend as though he's assimilated among the Plishtim. He's even going to, as we're going to say, he married a Plishti girl. He was Megayer, who the Rambam stresses, but still, it made it seem like he's assimilating among the Goyim and intermarrying with them. Now, when he goes and does his various exploits against them, they're not going to think that he's doing it as a Jew. They're going to think he's doing it as the Meshugan of Shimshon, and what can we do as long as he's powerful? We really have no way of doing anything to him. So we see, for example, in the Psukim, so he marries this Plishti girl, then already during the Sheva Brachas, already he starts, he poses a riddle to the Plishtim, he says, if you can't solve it, then you're going to have to give me clothing and sheets, and if you do solve it, then I'm going to have to give you, and they worm the secret out of his wife, and he gets angry and goes and kills a bunch of random Plishtim in order to pay off the bet. But now at this point, people think, you know, some kind of homicidal maniac, you know, what can you rate him on, you get him angry, he's going to go kill random people, but they're not thinking of him as a Jew. Then you have, he comes back, he comes back sometime later, he wants to make up with his wife, her father tells him, sorry, I already married her off to somebody else, so Shimshon says, now I'm going to get back at the Plishtim, because you did such a horrible thing, taking a man's wife and giving her to somebody else, so he goes and takes foxes and burns all their crops, and they say, who did this? Shimshon, the son-in-law of the man from Timnah. Again, they're not even identifying him as Shimshon the Jew, and they go and burn down the house of Shimshon's father-in-law and his wife, and Shimshon says, now I have even more reason to take revenge on you. So it's a whole cycle of violence over there, where everything they do, everything he does, causes them to think, well, what can we do? I'm a sugarner, and then they do something, and he uses that as an excuse for something else against them, and it keeps on going like that. So, nevertheless, the Mishnah is saying that in a certain sense, he followed his eyes, as we'll learn in the Gemara, and l'fichach nikru plishtim esenov, therefore eventually the plishtim knocked out his eyes. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, v'yichazuh plishtim, the plishtim arrested him after the whole thing with Delilah, where she wormed the secret out of him of what his strength, and she shaved off his hair, so then he lost his strength, so the plishtim grabbed him, v'yinakru esenov, and they put out his eyes. So, midah k'neged midah. Similarly, Avshalom nisgar b'sarei. Avshalom, the son of David, who rebelled against him and tried to make himself king, he was proud of his hair. We find in the Psukim that he was a Nazir Olam. The Gemara explains, and we learned a Nazir not so long ago. He was a Nazir Olam, and he would shave his hair only once every 12 months, and his hair grew profusely, and it weighed an enormous amount, and he was very proud of it, and it made him look beautiful, and all that. Lefichach nit, and he thought because of that, his good looks was one thing that he thought. Therefore the Jewish people will follow him because he looks good. He looks like a king should look. But the Lefichach Nitla Besaira, therefore in the end he was hanged on a tree by his hair. The Pasuk describes during a battle against David's forces, so they're in a forest over there, and Avshalom is riding on his mule under a large tree, and his hair gets caught in the tree, and he's hanging over there. The mule meanwhile left, and he's hanging over there in the tree by his hair. Marsha points out, actually, it doesn't actually say in the Pasuk in so many words that he was hanged by his hair. It just says he was hanged in the tree. But since the Pasuk says that his head got stuck in the tree, is mashma not his head itself, but rather his hair, and the reason would be because he was proud of his hair. And Lafisha Baal Esther Pilagshit Aviv. Now Avshalom had relations with his father's 10 Pilagshin. The Psukim described in Sefer Shmuel when Avshalom gets his people together and then comes to Yerushalayim and seizes the kingship, then David thinks to himself, I don't want to stay in Yerushalayim. There's going to be a whole civil war then. Innocent people might get hurt in the crossfire. So he says the best thing would be for me to leave Yerushalayim and at least temporarily abdicate, and then we'll see what happens. So David left 10 Pilagshim to guard the palace. Now, further on, and so can be described, Avshalom has his advisors. He has Ahitophel as his chief advisor, and then there's another advisor named Hushai Ha'arki, a friend of David, who's secretly acting on behalf of David. So Avshalom says to Ahitophel, what do you advise? What's our next step now that I'm in control of Yerushalayim? And Ahitophel tells him, go have relations with those 10 Pilagshim, and that way everybody will realize that the break between you and your father is irrevocable. Otherwise, people are going to be nervous to support you, because they're going to think, you know what, soon enough, Avshalom and his father are going to make up, and then anybody who supported Avshalom is going to be judged a murdered b'malchus. But if you do that, then everybody's going to realize it's an irreparable break. Your father, the king, would never forgive you after that, and therefore people will be more encouraged to support you. The Or Chaner has an explanation in Masechta Sanhedrin of a reason al pi halacha, a complicated reason al pi halacha, why that might cause him to support him. But anyway, the point is, because he did that, lefichach nitnu by eser lunvius. Therefore, he was stabbed with 10 spears. Shenema, as you have in the Pasuk over there, when he's hanging in the tree, so the Pasuk says, so first what happens is, a soldier from David's army comes and reports to Yoav that Avshalom is hanging there in the tree. So Yoav says, no, why don't you kill him? The soldier says, because David told us not to. Yoav says, never mind that, I'm going to deal with the matter. So first the Pasuk says, he took three darts and stuck them into Avshalom's heart, which the Mishnah is going to mention that point next. Avshalom's still alive, so then the Pasuk says, 10 armies bearers of Yoav surrounded Avshalom, still hanging on the tree, by Yaakov Avshalom, and they struck Avshalom and killed him. Each one took out their spear and stabbed him, so he was stabbed 10 times, corresponding to the 10 Pilagshim. And all the fish had gone of Shalosh Levavos, or Gnevis. Now, Avshalom also earlier, but when he was trying to drum up support for himself, so how did he do it? So the Pasuk described that for the first thing Avshalom did was, when he starts, he would stand every day by the gates of the palace, and when people would come to David for judgment, he would ask them, where are you from, how are you doing, etc., and try to and make himself like he's friendly with them, and explain, you know what, my father, David, is not necessarily going to be so fair to you in judgment. He's going to be more showing favoritism to other people, whereas I would judge you fairly. And with that, over time, he gained himself a following of people who think that he would be a better king than David. But then he stole 3 hearts. Lev Aviv, there was his father, because when Avshalom is ready to actually begin the revolt and to seize the kingship, he tells David that I want to go to Hebron, and he claims that I have korbanos that I need to bring over there. He claims that as a Nazir, he has to bring korbanos over there, and I made a neder that I'm going to bring them, and David tells him, go ahead. So he stole David's heart, he misled David in giving him permission to go to Hebron, which is where he started his revolt. So that's the first heart. The Lev Bastion, then he also misled Bastion. What did he do? The Pasuk describes over there with Avshalom that he went. He had 200 men who went with him who didn't know what's going on. They're kruim v'holchem l'sumam. The Pasuk says they were invited, but they were going innocently, not knowing what it's for, and then they ended up being Avshalom's supporters. What happened? Rashi brings from the Gemara Yerushalmi over here. What Avshalom is telling David, I need to go to Chevron. Because I have a neder to fulfill over there. Now, a prince is not going to go all by himself. I need people to go with me. It's only derech eretz. So please write me a letter with your seal that I should that any two people that I find I should be able to take with me, and they'll be my entourage. So he does that. So David writes out such a letter and stamps it. So then Avshalom takes it to two people, two Talmid Chachamim, heads of Batei Dinim, and shows it to them, and they follow him. Then he shows it to two others, and that's how he gathered his 200 followers, two at a time. So therefore, he stole their hearts. He misled them to thinking that all they're doing is, first of all, every one of them thinks that they're the only ones, and really they're only one of 100 such groups. And second of all, they don't realize that they're going in order to be Avshalom's core of supporters. The Lev Kol Yisrael, and then Avshalom also misled the Jewish people, because like we said, he would stand there by the gate and try to convince everybody that he would be a much fairer king than David. Lefichach nitku by shloisha shvatim. Because of that, three staffs or three darts or whatever were stuck into him. Shenema, as the pasuk says again, when Yoyo first saw him hanging on the tree, he took three sticks in his hand, and stuck them into Avshalom's heart. And still he's alive there, and in the midst of the tree of the oak or elm or whatever it is kind of tree that he was hanging from. And then came the 10 arms bearers and killed him. So therefore, everything was midi k'neged midi. With Avshalom, he was proud of his hair. Therefore, he was hanged by his hair. He violated the 10 pilagshim. Therefore, he was stabbed with 10 spears, and he stole three hearts, three different groups of people that he misled, and therefore he was stabbed with three sticks or darts or whatever. And Anach Yosef deals with the question, why is the Mishnah mentioning the 10 before the 3? The actual events was first he was stabbed with the 3, and then with the 10. And he explains, because otherwise you could say, listen, you know, it so happens, Yoav had 10 sons, had 10 arms bearers, and each of them stabbed him. So you wouldn't necessarily say that that's midah k'neged midah. But once we see when it says mi noisik klo Yoav, it could mean, in other words, that it has so happened that he has exactly 10 arms bearers. But now that you say noisik klo Yoav implies, in other words, that there are exactly 10, and all of them struck him. But now also you have they see that he was already stabbed 3 times, and he's still not dead yet, and therefore all of them killed him. So we see, in other words, that it's all midah k'neged midah. So therefore, the Mishnah mentions first the 10 and then the 3, because in other words, it's from the fact that there were 10 exactly that stabbed him that we realize that that as well as the 3 is all midah k'neged midah. So the Gemara is going to deal with in detail the various details of the stories of Shimshon and Avshalom. We'll start with that tomorrow, Beis Hashem. One thing worth mentioning in this connection, here the Gemara, the Mishnah is saying that Shimshon's problem was his eyes, and Avshalom was with his hair. There the Maharal makes a point that the eye is never satisfied, and therefore in that sense, with Shimshon, with his eyes, it represents, in other words, that he's never satisfied with what he has, with what levels he's reached in Avodah, and he's always looking for more, but eventually that tripped him up, and he went the wrong way, whereas Avshalom, it's the other way around. The hair represents most of the samotion. It represents like something that's extra, something that grows out of a person that's not really necessary, and that represents that he's looking for more than he deserves. And then, therefore, we're saying that his hair was the instrument through which he ended up getting trapped in the tree and killed. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gola, speaking of Rosh Chodesh, Aleph Iyar, Rosh Chodesh. So the pasuk says, "V'hoyu midi chodesh v'chodesh midi Shabbos v'Shabbatay." Every Rosh Chodesh after Mashiach comes, every Shabbos, Yovich Chobosel Yishtachvus Lefanei Amar Hashem. So the Medrash explains on it that Hashem says, "In Olam Hazeh, in the previous Batei Mikdash, you would go 3 times a year. Now, when the Ketz comes, you're going to come there every single Rosh Chodesh. But how people are going to be living all over the world, because, like it says elsewhere in the Medrash, Eretz Yisrael will expand to be the whole world. So how people coming to Sofa Olam, to the Beis Mikdash on Shabbos? So clouds will come and carry them to Yerushalayim, and they'll be able to daven there Shabbos morning." So the Rebbe explains in a sicha, that means, in other words, the clouds, now the question is, how are they traveling on Shabbos? It means that the clouds will bring them there on Friday, before Shabbos begins,
Because it has to be that way if you're going to say it means that come Shabbos morning, then you have all kinds of complicated things as far as the Zman when Shabbos begins, and even nowadays have a question, for example, a person is on a plane, and then time zones and Shabbos, and it becomes very complicated. So to avoid all that, the vote is that they'll come there before Shabbos begins, both at their departure and their destination, and therefore that way it avoids all the problems. Continuing with halachas of Motzei Shabbos. So after Havdalah, you should have some extra candles. That's why by Malacha Malka, you light candles, and you have the zmiris that the people sing Motzei Shabbos also to have derech kovod. You have Malacha Malka, like you escort a king when he's leaving the city. We mentioned Eliyahu HaNavi, and we mentioned that he should come and then tell us about the Gola. Why Davka on Motzei Shabbos? Because the Gemara tells us that Eliyahu won't come on Erev Shabbos in order not to distract us from preparing for Shabbos. Mind you, that everyone said in a Sicha, Eliyahu can come on Erev Shabbos, nobody will mind. People would rather be distracted from their Shabbos preparations and be Mashiach is coming, but fine, the Gemara does say that Eliyahu is not coming on Erev Shabbos, so therefore Motzei Shabbos, then, which is the next time that he can come, because there's this question of Yesh Tchum and Lamayim, and Shabbos itself, there's the whole question of Yesh Tchum and Lamayim, so therefore after Shabbos then means this next time that Eliyahu can come, so therefore we mention him. Also, the Medrash says every Motzei Shabbos Eliyahu goes into Gan Eden and sits under the Eitz HaChaim and writes down the Schusim of Jewish people who keep Shabbos, so therefore now we want to mention him for good in gratitude for the fact that he's writing down our Schusim.